It's the Lawyers Guns and Money podcast. Today's episode features Robert Farley and Daniel Nexon. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Dan. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I'm just sitting in my virus bunker, my educational bunker, as I like to call it, which is my basement where I have a complete audio-video setup for recording all sorts of fun things. And I'm thinking about the fact that international politics look pretty grim right now.
Things do look pretty grim. I am sitting in my office at the Patterson Office Tower, where I am, as far as I can tell, the only human being on this floor. So really, there is no better place for me to social distance than my workplace in this case.
So what do you make of the fact that we are seeing, I think in the last 15 to 20 years, historically low levels of cooperation on global collective goods problems? That is, we're seeing historically low levels of cooperation on disease.
So my first question about that is that I'm curious about that time frame, right? To say this last 15 to 20 years, you know, I thought that part of our conclusion, part of the conclusion, the argument that Dan Dreser makes, for example, it's not about disease, but I mean, his argument in the system worked, right, is that we did see lots of policy coordination in 2008, 2009 that avoided turning the Great Recession into the New Depression. And so it seems like to me the disjuncture here is happening after the 2008-2009 time frame, and that we're sort of in new territory right now. But that new territory, we've only been here for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. This is the problem if you're doing any kind of prognostication. It's very difficult to tell whether what we're seeing now is a function specifically of the Trump administration. That is to say that we have a anti-multilateralist, anti-quote-unquote globalist, inward-working leadership in the country that is still, I think, the dominant power in the world, even with China's rapid rise. And how much of this is the fact that of China's rapid rise, right? And how much of this is a power transition dynamic?
Right. Well, I think what some people also would argue that, and I think you'd find this in a lot of different places, both on the left and on the right, is that the 2008-2009 disjuncture sort of is the cause, right? The system did work, but it worked in a way that essentially delegitimized future collective international action, right? And so the left argument, but also Steve Bannon's argument, would be like both inside the United States and internationally, the result of pausing the Great Recession was that the system continued to function for the most well off, and you didn't have a complete disruption, but it delegitimized both domestic institutions and international institutions in a way that, you know, produces Trump, produces Bolsonaro, produces Orban in Hungary, and fundamentally delegitimizes international institutions.
I mean, I think. So this is the indirect route, right? This is the idea that the neoliberal technocratic solution that didn't tackle fundamental problems of inequality, that pushed globalization even further, produced counter-order movements. And those counter-order movements were populist in various ways and skeptical of international cooperation. I can see that. That story, of course, doesn't necessarily work for every country. So if you want to look at the real rise of populism as a potent force in Europe, it surrounds the refugee crisis, not the Great Recession. I think in the United States, you know, the political science is still out on this, but I think the bulk of the political science suggests that it really isn't economic factors that are driving the rise of nativism here. Essentially, we have a political entrepreneur in the form of Trump who seized on the cutting edge of conservative thought, you know, which was more nativist, which was more racially charged, and turned that up to 11, and thus activated a whole set of identities and political discourses that were already there, but he activated them further. If you're going to make this case, you're going to argue the mini recession in the Rust Belt tipped the election to Trump, but that's not an argument about some fundamental trend where globalization being done by evil elites in 2008, 2009 is somehow giving us fascism today, or crypto-fascism, or whatever you want to call it.
Right. Although, you know, so I mean, the refugee. So to take this back and to look at it in the context of Europe, I mean, the refugee crisis does seem to be the inflection point for Europe. But I think, I mean, we see the collapse of center-left parties before the ref. It's, I mean, center-left parties are unable to handle the refugee crisis, but they're collapsing before that, right? We see really them losing out in a lot of ways before we even get to the Syrian refugee crisis, don't we? I mean, that's pretty much a European-wide phenomenon where the center-left is falling apart in response to challenges from both the left and the right, even before the Syrian refugees start ending up on their shores.
Yeah, I mean, that might be true. I have made arguments about the economic origins of the current kind of situation before. That is, I've played around with these arguments about failures of economic policy, inequality, driving our current condition. I just think that it's hard to sort out the various causal dynamics. And so I think saying, you know, the fact that the system worked in 2008, 2009 prevented structural reforms that would have happened had the system worked, and therefore led, or had the system not worked, and therefore led to the rise of nativist parties and right-wing populist parties, which are therefore torpedoing international cooperation. To me, that's you're reading a lot of inevitability to a fairly contingent story out of that. And if you want to make the case that there are broader problems in the Western advanced industrialized democracies that are weakening parties, right, getting partisanship in the United States but with weaker parties, or that have hurt the center, particularly the center left in Europe, that's fine. But I think that the idea that specific, that 2008, 2009, it's an inflection point because the Great Recession does certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't see it, right? So labor would have lost no matter what happened at the global level in 2008, 2009, giving us Cameron, right? And Cameron, you know, and in fact, it was his fear he was going to lose in the next election that led him to propose the Brexit referendum.
Right.
So I just don't know. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence that Orbanism has anything to do with the Great Recession. It does have economic drivers, like the fact that the urban populations are doing much better, that you have brain drain and youth drain out of Hungary, and you have the standard urban-rural split that's developing as an axis of political contention in a lot of countries. But I don't think Orbanism is tied to something that has to do with the Great Recession. I don't think Erdogan is tied to something that has to do with the Great Recession. I don't think Duterte in the Philippines has anything to do with the Great Recession,
as best I can tell.
Bolsonaro's, you know, indirectly, right, you have the recession hits Brazil in such a way that it affects support for parties there. But the reason we have Bolsonaro's in Brazil is not because of neoliberalism and the Great Recession. It's because of other dynamics. And so I think there's a danger that we move from this is a contributing cause to a kind of primary contradiction story where we want everything to fit our ideological priors and to be consistent
right,
with our
right.
policy prescriptions. And here I think there's a real danger there. I think if you run the counterfactual and Clinton wins in 2012, I mean, I'm sorry, 2016, and she isn't impeached and removed, which is a real possibility, I think. But if you run that counterfactual, I think she's managing this crisis much better. If you run a counterfactual where Cameron is still in power in Great Britain, or even May is still in power in Great Britain, and Johnson's a buffoon, but he's, I think, better. He's more predisposed towards international, you know, the kind of G7 type of stuff that we might have gotten with U.S. leadership. I think you can run this counterfactual where we have better leadership in the West and we get a more coordinated, more competent response. And so, and I think that counterfactual is plausible even given the handling of the 2008 recession, 2008, 2009.
Right. Right. So, I'm not even sure it's worth going into right now. There are a lot of people who would say that, you know, even sort of looking you know, whether we're trying to find out where the break is in the system, right? And some people say, well, it's 2003 is the break in the system. It's 2008. I mean, I don't think we have to figure out what our answer to that is. And I think you've done a good job of punching holes in this. It was the Great Recession argument, which, again, is like Steve Bannon's argument.
Wait, I want to interrupt you here for a second. What do you mean by the break in the system? What are you talking about?
Sort of when the system is breaking, right? So I think we would agree right now that there is something fundamentally wrong with how international society is handling the coronavirus disaster, right? That we could look at an alternative reality, and an alternative reality that I would have expected to exist with respect to international cooperation and even coordination around certain outcomes that could have been different than what we see now, right? Where you have much greater cooperation, where you don't have China and the United States sniping at each other with conspiracy theories about where the virus came from, where you don't have Chinese propaganda undermining the position of the EU in Italy and elsewhere, in the midst of this plague-ridden disaster. I mean, it feels like to me we are in a situation where both domestically and internationally the system is not working. Right? It's not working.
Well, I agree it's not working. I guess I'm curious about this idea of a break because, again, I think counterfactually you get a couple of elections going differently,
sure,
and the system's going to work much better than it does now.
The break can be November 2016, right? I mean, right.
But if you're talking
or the Brexit election,
right? But if you're talking more broadly about sort of the high point of international cooperation, you know, maybe you're putting it in the late 90s or something, or the mid 90s. I mean, this is kind of too rosy, right? There was a lot of stuff going down there that, you know, the Chinese were pissed at us for bombing their embassy in Kosovo. The Russians were really angry about a whole bunch of things. But if you want to look back at the 1990s, for example, as your counterfactual, I'm not sure that that was ever sustainable. Right? That was really a moment of U.S.
Right.
global, unchallengeable U.S. global hegemony, where you had a government that was really multilaterally inclined in the United States in many ways. It doesn't mean it to do unilateral action, but was ideologically predisposed towards building global governments, right? In many respects.
Right.
So,
and
you also had that under Obama, right, to some degree.
Right. Projecting from the future of the 1990s into what people had hoped, what sort of a Clinton administration had hoped, right? What the future of international society is going to look like, you know, on the one would be the gradual inclusion of China into responsibly into the organizations and mechanisms of international governance in ways which were not going to completely disrupt those, and that would tame China, right? So there is that hope, right? The understanding that China needs to be tamed, but also China needs to be included, and this is a gradual process which can take a while, but needs to be done. Sort of a same feeling around Russia, which is not that Russia is going to be as important as China, but that Russia isn't firebombing the system, right? That sort of Russia's long-term inherent proclivities to being a chaos muppet are also sort of tamed in some way, right? And at some point, both of those hopes break down, or maybe there is no point at which they break down, but it seems no one any longer seems to hold those, whether, you know, we are projecting from the future of 1997 or from the future of 2010.
Right. I mean, there are like 30 different inflection points with Russia.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the thing about that, right? So you can look at the Kosovo invasion as an inflection point. You can look at Bush's sort of dismissal. It's not his dismissal. Like, he initially, Putin's very excited about the possibility of a great kind of entente against Islamic terrorism. And Bush both kind of ignores Russia and also pushes the freedom agenda in ways that makes Russia worried about its regime survival, right? So your Keller revolutions, et cetera, et cetera. You can tell that as a kind of inflection point in the Russian relationship. You can talk about Iraq, you can talk about Libya, you can talk about Ukraine even, right? There are like a billion different points at which we can say maybe there was a different way to go. So it's hard to do. in China, you want to run this thing, you really want to run this thing. This would be the kind of, the US hadn't given most favored nation status, permanent MFN to China in the 90s, or hadn't pushed, gotten China into the WTO so quickly, right? Maybe this would have done differently because China just wouldn't have grown the way that it did. So there are a whole bunch of ways you can kind of rerun this experiment and potentially come up with different results, or rerun the simulation and come up with different results. But to me, it's more interesting to sort of ask what are the processes that have that are operating that we're seeing create problems for that are sort of showing up that where the pandemic's revealing just how kind of messed up the system is. And those, again, I think you're right there to point to the rise of right-wing populism as a problem. I think we also have the more general power transition. We have the specific manifestation of right-wing populism in the United States, which is Trumpism, which has really taken the United States out of this game in important ways. You've got all of that.
Right, and so our result is, I mean, I guess when you look out at the world, because I know you think a lot about, obviously, U.S. hegemony, and you think a lot about, we all think about international cooperation. I mean, what is most interesting to you in how nations have coordinated or failed to coordinate in response to this epidemic?
Well, what's most interesting for me is the failure to coordinate, period. Right? And that suggests that we've got a problem. But even beyond the failure to coordinate, I mean, so some of the stuff like is just pure Trump. The fact that Trump doesn't even tell the Europeans we're going to ban flights to Europe or flights from Europe, that he does so in a way that it indicates he has no idea about anything about Europe, right, with the Schengen group and things like that. That he just doesn't understand anything about how this works. So you've got that, but I think the most troubling aspect of all of this is the way that. So you could have a situation in which everybody says, we've got a global pandemic. Yes, it's got some countries will lose more than others. There are some distributional consequences, but they're unpredictable. This is a huge problem. We've got to get our act together. We've got to manage this. We've got to coordinate. We've got to fund. We've got to do a coordinated global governance solution. That would be the sort of way that you would hope it would be handled. Instead, what you alluded to at the beginning, we have basically the pandemic inflaming U.S.-Chinese tensions, being seized on as an opportunity by both sides to push their global politically competitive agenda with one another. That to me is the most troubling thing because it suggests that in the face of the kind of crisis which you might think would spur some sort of collective identification among states about having a common problem, instead we're getting a ramp up in great power tensions. And that, as I posted at Blair's Money, this bodes very poorly for some of the optimistic scenarios about what a world of multiple great powers is going to look like going forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, I share that alarm, right? I mean, and I've been reading a lot about a lot of, I've been trying to track down a lot of academic work about the Spanish influence, the Spanish flu, and sort of how states reacted to that. And obviously, the cooperative environment of 1918, 1919 is much different than what we have now. And it is the case that the British leveraged the flu in certain ways to put more pressure on the Germans and to inflict more pain upon the Germans in peace negotiations. But, you know, they were already at war, right? And so in some, I mean, you did not see countries sort of being evangelical or being opportunistic about blaming other countries for bringing about the virus or blaming other countries for failing to react to it in a productive way. And I should say here that I suspect you're in agreement that both the U.S. and the Chinese governments are at substantial fault in their reactions to the virus so far, right? The Chinese in covering it up, and the U.S. in really our haphazard reaction. So there's plenty of criticism. It's not just not the criticism that either side is actually directing at the other.
Well, I do think that the attacks by our government on China do have at their root the fact that China covered up the virus for a significant amount of time and denied WHO access, for example, although this, ultimately they don't give a shit about WHO. This is labeled as explicit, right? This podcast. Okay.
Yeah.
So they don't give a shit
This
about
is an
you.
adult's, this is an adult, this is an adult podcast.
Right, okay, all right. So that being said, right, so I think that's a big part of it. You can also, of course, make the case that the Chinese did share the genome. They did give us time. So, it's not a black and white situation. I just think the critique, I mean, I think what you're getting at is the critique is largely opportunistic. And it's designed to deflect attention from Trump administration failures. It's designed to serve a prior nativist agenda. And in China, the same thing is happening, right? The weaponization of the virus, weaponization of narratives about the virus as being the Trump virus, as being something that China handled really well, that China is helping the world out while the United States stands idly by. These are also, there's some truth to that, but they're also opportunistic efforts to deflect attention from the failures of the Communist Party and the really actually fairly big blow to domestic legitimacy that the virus created initially in China. They're both using it for purposes of regime survival and prior regime preferences. And so, yes, I mean, and the fact that they can do so is a function, it's not completely manufactured. Both sides, as you say, have made some fairly serious mistakes that are blameworthy. And some of that is just inevitable, but some of that is also specific to the pathologies of the two systems.
Right. I mean, so I mean, what is the like the rosy story about this is that this, which is obviously an international coordination problem, would have sort of refueled or reinvigorated institutions and norms and processes that are associated with international cooperation and the kind of coordination cooperation that is necessary to fight something that's not a country, but is a disease which is just killing people randomly. And yet, the opposite is happening, right? And so, you have just written a book called Exit from Hegemony, right? So, I mean, is this part of the process of the end of American hegemony and the establishment of a sort of a new form of international social ordering?
So it's a little bit disturbing because what we're seeing now basically follows the template of what we argue in the book is happening. And that's not because we're brilliant. All of the trend lines we see in the book are ones that other people have identified. We've just put them together in a neat little package. So yeah, we see all of the. So in the book, I think I've mentioned this before, we say that there are three main processes underway that have already kind of torpedoed American global hegemony as we understood it in the late 90s and early 2000s, and now are placing the core American system, hegemonic system, at risk. And those are primarily rooted in overarching power transition dynamics. That is, they're rooted in the economic rise of China and the relative economic decline of the United States. And those three mechanisms are alternative order construction and contestation by great powers, that is China and Russia, and even some other states, but primarily China, rooting around the existing infrastructure of international order, developing its own development banks, its own ecology of development assistance, developing some of its own security institutions. And there's actually just been an explosion in the number of new ties between China and other states through new forum and new organizations in the last 10 years. It's striking. We have a map of the increased network ties in the book, and it's really crazy. It's actually fairly high for Russia as well. And so you get contestation within the order, attempts to strip out political liberalism from the order, human rights requirements, civil rights requirements, political rights requirements. And then you have an attempt to also bypass the order by setting up your own institutions that don't have some of those pesky liberal elements. Secondly, and relatedly, you have increased demand for alternative patronage from countries like China and Russia, in part because they're there and they can do it, in part because once you start to see the hegemon decline, you start thinking, well, maybe we should go elsewhere. In part because of various kinds of policy decisions the United States has made that has made cooperation for some countries with the United States look less attractive. And so you get, and this is what we call it, the breakdown in U.S. monopoly patronage, right? The U.S. had a de facto patronage monopoly in the 90s. It was the only source of development assistance, the only source of credible security guarantees. Now, when we say it, what we really mean is it and the other advanced industrialized democracies, right? And we mean their institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. So the alternative patronage, the availability of alternative patrons, both allows states to actually exit from US patronage relationships and the kinds of conditions and liberal ordering associated with them, that is often associated with them, and with just US influence associated with them. And it also allows them to leverage the threat of exit to get better bargains. That is to shield themselves, just as, and this is what happened during the Cold War, where conditionality was ineffective and the US was very unlikely to ever trigger a lot of conditions or trigger a lot of this sort of stuff because it would threaten, because it might enhance Soviet power. And this is sort of the debate about Carter's human rights policy in the late 70s. And then the third, which is what we were talking about earlier, is the rise of counter-order movements, which in many ways is being fed by the existence of alternative patrons and alternative order building. And these counter-order movements right now are chiefly far-right movements, but they also could be far-left movements. And then, of course, the fact that you have countries like Russia who have decided to insert themselves as brokers and try to forward these movements and make them more successful as a way of disrupting Western order. So we see all of this playing out right now, right? The Chinese are already talking about an alternative health infrastructure that would bypass the World Health Organization, where presumably they would have more votes and more control. We're already seeing the Chinese stepping in to provide, even if some of this is kind of BS, right? So, for example, the aid to Italy mostly comes in the form of things that the Italians had bought already, right? It's not actually nice largesse by the Chinese, as I understand it, but stepping up and providing goods and saying, we are here to help you with the virus, both by providing you with technical expertise and providing you with assistance with ventilators and things like that, while the United States is AWOL, right? So that's the
Oh,
kind of goods.
AWOL and or openly hostile, right?
And so China is exploiting that. And then counter-order movements, I think there's an interesting dimension here. I mean, not only is the fact that the US is so bad at this a function of, in taking the stance that it's taking, a consequence of one of those counter-order movements controlling the White House right now, right? Trumpism and Trump. But it's also a function, it's also playing out in some of the ways in which populists are trying to use the crisis to, as any outside external party would, to delegitimize the parties in control, but it's also the way in which populists have seized on Chinese assistance to say, hey, we don't need the United States, we don't need the European Union, they're not doing us any good, we can go elsewhere. This is a phenomena that Alex Cooley and I call multipolar populism, and that's clearly playing out in places like Italy and Serbia. And in Italy, in fact, even the pro-EU parties have kind of jumped on the bandwagon, which is in part a consequence of being pushed there by their populist coalition. In a sense, they don't want to be outbid by their five-star populist coalition members or by the Liga, right, the opposition right-wing populist movement. So all of this is really happening, and it's happening. And what seems to be the case right now is the coronavirus has sort of accelerated these trends even further. So, yeah, it kind of looks like the book.
I mean, are you surprised? So, it's not exactly as if novel coronavirus is entirely novel and that we couldn't predict that there was going to be some sort of pandemic at some point, right? I mean, the federal government even exercised, they did exercises based around this, right? But sort of from your scholarly point of view, would you have expected the reaction to since really since December to have been the retrenchment of the system or the further disintegration of the system? Is there, I mean, so obviously this goes along with sort of the general thrust of your argument about the exit from hegemony, right? But are you just sort of looking out and seeing exactly what you would hope or not hope to see, obviously, but are you surprised that this conforms so well with the expectations in the book?
Well, I'm surprised and I'm not surprised, right? Which is to say, I'm not surprised because I'm now supposed to be defending the book and I'm supposed to think that it's, that this is exactly what we should, we're seeing what we should be seeing. So in that sense, I shouldn't be surprised intellectually, but I am always somewhat surprised. This is going to sound weird, but I am never not shocked by the gross incompetence of the Trump administration in handling crises and in managing U.S. power. Even though we should know better by now, it still, at some visceral level, surprises me because it's just so ridiculous, right? It's unnecessary. It's the result of having people who, think they're getting better advice from the random Serbian official they meet than from their own intelligence agencies that are kind of really in bed with this global network of corruption and self-dealing. And it's still just kind of fundamentally shocking to see that at the highest levels of the US government, to see Jared fucking Kushner pushing policies that are derived from conversations he has with his buddies in Silicon Valley who are excited about the latest tech fix, right? It's just really fucking shocking. And it's really fucking shocking. And I did, yeah, I mean, as soon as it's really fucking shocking to see the US over the last 3 years. I mean, yes, we're in relative decline. Yes, global hegemony is over. But it's really fucking shocking to just see us rip up all of these capabilities and resources that we have, diplomatic, infrastructural, multilateral, that served US interests on the whims of this, failed businessman, right?
Yeah, I mean, I am shocked that I am not shocked that Kushner was attempting to develop a public policy response by asking the dad of one of his model friends to ask his Facebook friends what we should do in terms of the response, right? I mean, that's just a
Although that was
shocking
better
story.
advice than they got from anyone else,
Oh yeah,
apparently.
well, no, and it was, right? But it's still, I mean, that's crazy, right? How could anyone think that this makes sense? And it doesn't, but it's not surprising. In
I mean,
really
are you
alarming ways.
surprised? I mean, are you shocked by any of it? You say you're not shocked by any of this, but I mean, at some basic level, are you just not surprised that we had a lot of the, even with the disbandment of the NSC pandemic cell, right, and its dispersal, that we had infrastructure, that we'd done things during the Ebola crisis, that we'd done things during SARS, that we'd done things during swine flu, right, that we just we had these templates, and we had templates for international cooperation, and just to see those things, and just to see those things not be, not be gone to at all. This at some visceral level doesn't surprise you.
Not anymore. No, not after watching this administration for 3 years. I mean, and we've always been asking this question, right? The Trump administration has mainly been about self-generating crises, right? That the crises have mostly been created by the administration itself. And this is one, and people have been saying for quite some time, well, what happens when there is a genuine external crisis? And we're here, and they are living down to the expectations that I have for them. And that's just, I mean, that's sort of reality playing the refs in a way with me. But yeah, I mean, it feels like right now I am beyond being shocked by any combination of malfeasance and incompetence coming out of this administration. And that said, his approval ratings are higher than they ever have been, so.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I was going to mention, is that he just came in as a net +4 in the latest Gallup poll. I guess we're told this is just a rally effect, but to me, it's just a reminder of how many people don't pay the level of attention to politics as we do. And I'm not even sure it's a function of these dog and pony shows every day. But I don't know. I mean, what's your sense? I'm certainly the people on the left, Bernie supporters, are blaming this on Biden being for them AWOL or maybe dead, right? That was the theory for a while. Do you think the Democrats can do anything to better handle this, or do you think it's fundamentally just a function of processes we should expect? And what's surprising is how low his approval rating remains despite a rally effect. I mean, what's your take?
No, I mean, I think that the rose-colored glasses are, you can argue they're on my face, but this feels like if this were switched, if the situation were switched, and it was in the middle of a disaster, my president was only polling 49 to 44, I would be desperately concerned. And so it feels like to me like a rally around the flag effect, but a pretty meager rally around the flag effect, given what we're going to see coming down in the next two quarters, basically, in terms of catastrophic extra economic effects and many people dying, right? And so if this is as good as we're going to get from the in terms of Trump's approval rating, and, you know, my predictions are always wrong, but my guess is it's pretty high. It's pretty close to what we're going to see in his peak. He has a lot to worry about. And I don't think it has anything to do with either Sanders or Biden at this point.
Are you at all worried that we still have room to fuck this up more, right, with this kind of go back to work movement and the way in which some Republican executives in some states have bought into all of this rhetoric?
I am at the same time, you know, I'm also pretty cognizant of, you know, that this is what I said on Twitter the other day, right, that Trump's policies are uncorrelated with any vision of the public good, right? But uncorrelated with a vision of the public good does not mean that they're always opposite, right? And so we should be resistant to sort of to buy into that any intervention that sort of brings the economy back to normality is necessarily something that is counterproductive. Just because Trump wants to make everything normal again on Easter does not mean that we shouldn't be developing a set of expectations and a set of plans for balancing the concern between the effect of the virus and the effect of the effect of the virus on lives and the effect of the virus on the economy. You know, my problem is that I just don't trust Trump to do anything useful. And so, yes, of course, I think that we can still fuck this up worse.
Well, that's really comforting. What do you think about the? I mean, this is outside of our area, but the bailout package, right? My sense is that the Democrats did get some useful concessions from what was looking like a fairly corporate pork-laden stimulus, but still, in American style, we're not doing this in a simple and more effective way. But certainly the Dow seems excited. I was just looking over, the Dow is up 857 points right now, which strikes me as bizarrely optimistic. But I mean, what's your sense? I mean, is the stimulus package going to be enough to weather the storm? Is that something that you have any sense of? You've talked to economists and you have any sense of?
I have not talked to any economists. I don't have a sense of it. I don't have a sense of yet of sort of how its details are going to affect. I mean, on a personal level, I can say that I'm already thinking about, you know, so I have two daughters. You have a daughter, right? And suddenly they're going to get $500 for some reason. You know, what are we going to do with that $500? You know, because the intention here, and, you know, perhaps the responsibility becomes incumbent upon us, is not to, like, just plow that $500 into the kids' education fund, but rather to use it for its intended purpose, which is the improvement of the economy. And so I'm thinking along those terms, but that's very micro.
That raises a good point, though, because, I mean, I kind of side with the people who said, don't means test, we just need to get all this stuff out the door. If you means test, you're going to undermine support for the income stabilization efforts. But I have to say that I don't know what we're going to spend this money on, right? I mean, maybe we'll give it to charity, you know, because it's not going to affect our consumption patterns. It's, you know, we both have secure jobs, and it doesn't, you know, it's not a nothing chunk of change to us. You know, we're not rich, but it's not something I would say, okay, now it's time to go out and buy a plasma TV. That was what we did in the 80s. It would now be, I guess, an OLED TV. I just don't see it, right? I don't see it as affecting that decision, even if we could go out and spend it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the short answer is that I don't have a strong sense right now of what the stimulus package is going to be. I mean, I think that, you know, some of the critiques about how the comparisons of how the Trump administration approached this as compared to the Obama administration, where, you know, Obama carefully negotiated with himself and produced a smaller stimulus, whereas Trump is just like big. You know, there is a useful story and a useful interpretation to be written about the different ways that Republicans and Democrats negotiate these things.
But this isn't even, I don't think this is complicated at all, right? I mean, you take Trump out of the equation, this is just the fact that McConnell is a raw Machiavellian, right? Republicans don't care about anything other than power. And So even getting the quote-unquote moderate senators on board with the stimulus in 2009 required pointless parebacks, right, to get the package down to 750 billion or whatever. So I mean, this is just a story about, frankly, to me, how the Republican Party is decadent and depraved, and we need a better conservative opposition party. And
Right.
but it's been obvious for years. I know that sounds super partisan, but I don't know what else to say. You run this counterfactual with Clinton as president, and there is no way the Republicans support a stimulus package like this.
No,
It's
no.
just not going to happen. And we know that because we saw what they did under Obama, where they deliberately tried to make the economic crisis worse to hurt him electorally.
Right. I concur.
The other thing about this, and we should wrap up soon, is we've been very focused on the United States and US power and the great powers, but there is a global dimension to this pandemic, right? And the COVID-19 is now spreading in the developing world. Indonesia is apparently in very bad shape, if Twitter is to be believed. We have breakouts throughout Africa. We have spread in Latin America. It's not only a pandemic problem in terms of lives lost directly outside of the developed world, it's also a huge economic problem. And as I linked to, and Will Wyckoff's been pointing, making sure that we all remember, part of what the Fed is doing is not, like in 2009, is not in 2008, is not just about the United States. It's about trying to play that economic hegemonic role of stabilizing the global economy, which is something the U.S. still has the capacity to do because of the centrality of its financial sector in internationally. Ian, so weirdly enough, we're doing the kinds of things you would want us to do on some fronts, even though Trump doesn't know and doesn't care, right?
Well, there's something that's interesting, and I don't know if Wyckoff has mentioned this, right? But this may not be unconnected with the fact that the Trump administration has, even more so than the previous two administrations, which also use many of the same tools, has really fallen in love with financial forms of coercion, right? And it does really seem to understand that you can reach out and hurt people with dollars and with U.S. control of the financial system. And really seems to value having that system because it enables that kind of coercion. And so that does seem to be in accord with sort of how the Trump administration has used coercive foreign policy, right? Sort of putting a
Right, but this
strong
is the
value.
right. I mean, they've piggybacked on U.S. financial power, and this has been the concerns that people like Henry Farrell and Abraham Newman have raised about this, is that they might be overusing it, right? If you use it too
Right.
much, then you incentivize states to root around the U.S. financial system, and a lot of states are trying to do this right now, Russia, China, etc. But what I mean is just basically the way in which the United States remains very important to global macroeconomic stability in terms of its policies, because it still has this kind of soft budget constraint, because it does sit at the center of the global financial network right now. And so we are playing that traditional role. I just don't know whether this is Britain in the Depression, where we're trying to do it, but our time has passed. We can't do it ourselves anymore, right? Or whether this is like some past examples where, in fact, ironically, U.S. power gets, economic power gets enhanced by crises. And I don't know which way that's going to go. But again, we're talking about the U.S. What I want to just point out is that I don't think we're getting enough consistent stream of information or paying enough attention to the utter devastation that this is going to wreck and is wrecking outside of Europe, the United
Right.
States, and developed East Asia. I mean, we're getting some of this in Iran, where it is just, I mean, I do you agree with me that it's unconscionable that we haven't
Oh, yeah.
temporarily lifted the sanctions there?
Oh, absolutely. No, I wholly concur. I wholly concur.
And that's the
And
kind of thing that, go on, sorry.
you're really finding people, for example, on Twitter who is really sorting out the people who are indifferent to human suffering and the people who actually care about living Iranians, right, in this situation. Because you still find people who are just strongly pro-sanction and who want to even turn the screws even harder on
Well, they
Iran.
think it's going to bring down the regime,
Right.
instead of giving them a convenient scapegoat, which is what always happens. I mean,
Right.
that's what happened. So, I mean, that's, as far as I understand it, what happened in Serbia with the sanctions is they actually helped Milosevic hold on to power for longer, because they gave him an excuse, they gave him a scapegoat. I mean, it's bizarre that Americans don't realize that, because we know exactly how we'd react under these circumstances.
Oh, absolutely.
So, anything else on
no,
this
no. I think that we would like to thank our listeners for once again listening to us, and hope that everybody is safe. I haven't noticed in the LGM comment threads many people talking about personal experiences with COVID-19, but I'm sure that some of our readership has. I'm sure that some of our commentariat has, and I think it's pretty much inevitable that we're going to find this in the families and in the persons of LGM before this is over. So,
yeah. So stay healthy, stay safe, wash your hands, hold your loved ones either literally or metaphorically tight.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much, Ben.
Hey, listeners. You've come to the end of another, as we like to think of it, delightfully amateurish episode of the LGM podcast. What's definitely not amateurish, however, is our music, which is provided by LGM contributor Elizabeth Nelson and her band, The Paranoid Style. Find The Paranoid Style's catalog wherever you find good music. Now, this is the point where I'm supposed to tell you that if you like the podcast and you like what we do at the blog, you should donate to our Patreon or directly via the link at lawyersgunsandmoney.com. I wanted to make two corrections, but in retrospect, they don't seem so important, so I'll just say that I know we weren't buying plasma TVs in the 1980s. That was, of course, in 2008, after the Bush economic stimulus plan. Hopefully, this stimulus plan will turn out to work a little bit better than that one did. All right, well, I'll let The Paranoid Style take us out.